This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This program contains themes of an adult nature. Word for Word is an in-depth look into the lives of real people, which means this episode may contain explicit accounts of real-life events, including alcohol and drug use. The language used at times may cause some offence, but has been left uncensored due to the accuracy of the story. No offence is intended, and we hope you enjoy the program.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, to over 70 community stations around the nation, this is Word for Word. Coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome, family and friends, fans and fiends, to today's edition of Word for Word. I want to thank you for tuning in today. I am Benjamin Norris, and it's simply a delight to continue to work on this show for the Joy Network, which has already featured some of the community's strongest voices. In the tradition of this ongoing program, I continue to look at the powerful stories and insights into the life and lifestyle of some incredible people. Each week, we will chat with those in and around our community who have inspired us, entertained us, but mostly they've made an impact on the queer community of Australia. Today's guest is one of them. This woman calls Sydney home and has been instrumental to the portrayal of the LGBTI community on screen in Australia. In an industry that has changed so much over the last 20 years, this screenwriter has welcomed many significant LGBTI characters into our homes. Writing on shows like Home and Away, Neighbours, and the popular Foxtel series Wentworth, her contribution to the Australian film and television industry is simply iconic. Currently working on an upcoming Netflix original series, she is a force to be reckoned with and hopes one day to win an Oscar. I'd like to welcome you, and I'd like to welcome Sarah Walker to Word for Word.
I don't know what it is about kids, but they can tell when somebody's different.
And her only crime was being different.
Been a long and wide career so far in television.
Best flaming place in the world, if you ask me. And I forever
and ever. Wentworth has become a huge hit in the UK.
I wonder which things you think are your greatest achievements as a writer.
And to speak the words and animate the dreams of others.
There'll always be winners and losers.
After 12 years on our screens, the final episode of All Saints airs tonight. That's when
is the importance of the writer in connection with performance and how interlinked that writing is with the actor's performance.
Female films with women at the centre are niche experiences. They are not. Audiences want to see them, and in fact, they earn money. And
I
walk with
intent. I learned a lot about writing for screen from acting because I learned what it's like when you're putting words in people's mouths. It's very good to know what it's like to have to interpret those on the other side of the camera. I've often wondered what makes us the way we are as gay people, and this is obviously everybody's on a scale.
Well, look, it's super exciting to have you here in the studio, so welcome.
Thank you.
And I have to say to you, this is such a privilege to have you here because I am obsessed with your writing, and I think the privilege that we have today is sharing your work with the LGBTI and queer audience that are listening.
Thank you very much. It's been a long and wide career so far in television, so yeah, lots to talk about if you have some questions for me.
Well, we certainly do. So you grew up in Sydney's West, is that right?
Correct. Grew up in Wylie Park, and I went to Wylie Park Girls High School, which was great. It's come in really handy lately because there's a lot of diversity coming through the industry at the moment, which has been fantastic. And I'm really lucky because there's all these green people that are coming through, new voices, and they need old voices or old heads in the room to kind of show them how to do it. And so I've been in the really lucky position of coming through with people like Fadia Aboud, who's a wonderful director, writer from the Arab community. And those people are teaching me something, which is fantastic. But it really stood me in good stead coming from Wylie Park and Lakemba, because I actually grew up with the community of Lebanese migrants coming into the, well, all sorts of migrants, but primarily by high school, the Lebanese community were moving into that area. And I just felt like I'd been part of it from the beginning. So it's been really great to come from that place.
It's great when you get to draw things from your experience, especially later on, and you can get to look back. But I have to ask, what were you like as a child growing up there?
I would say lonely.
Really?
I think so, yeah. I was also a bit obsessive, I think. I can remember having a crush on my, well, no, I'm not going to say my kindergarten teacher. It was someone else's kindergarten teacher. She wasn't even my teacher. And I can remember she one day was miraculously sitting on my front fence in my block of flats because, as I didn't realize, but her niece lived next door. And so this incredible moment in my life where my goddess was sitting on the front fence, and next door there was a building, you know, the house had been torn down and they were building a new set of flats. And I thought I would impress her. I was 5 years old and I picked up a brick and started doing some, you know, weightlifting on one arm with the brick up in the air to show her how strong I was. And I dropped the brick and it fell on my arm and cut my arm. And she thought I was crying because I hurt myself, but I crying because my ego was so injured with my prowess with the brick. So look, that was the story of my entire childhood, I think. I was just obsessed with people I admired and dreamt about, and I didn't have a lot of friends because in those days, I don't know what it is about kids, but they can tell when somebody's different. I don't know why. Even when I was in primary school, I was really unpopular, and it was something to do with not being able to dress the way the other girls dressed, or I didn't have the same interests. I didn't wear bikini tops at the beach or at the pool right up until I was 8 or 9 years old.
What were you wearing?
Just the bottoms of whatever. So I looked like a boy, but I had really long hair because my mum had kept my hair long. And I can, all the time, kids used to come up to me at the pool and say, "Are you a boy or a girl?" I was very confusing for them because I had the long hair, but then I wasn't wearing traditional feminine attire in the pool.
And what was your body language like, though?
Probably boyish, actually.
Yeah, right.
When I look back at photos, my favourite photos of myself as a child, I look like a young boy with only shorts on, no top, and running around wild like my brother did, or my brother got to do. And when I was about, I think, 9, my grandmother always used to, they came from Orange, so a small town, and my grandmother wanted to always dress up to go down to the shops.
Into town?
Yeah. The beads and the stockings came out and everything was perfect, and the hair was, you know, permed with the blue rinse and everything.
Love it.
And she wanted me to look like a girl. So this particular day, my brother and I were having coffee with her or something, lunch, and she'd asked me to dress up, and I wouldn't put a dress on, so she got me a pantsuit which was red and had little flowers on the collar. And they made this really big fuss of the fact that how pretty I looked and how lovely it was and what a lovely little girl I was and all of these things. And I'm starting to, you know, drink the Kool-Aid and think, oh, I must look really good. And my brother and I were sitting at the table and the waitress came up and said, "What would the boys like?" And that waitress picked up, the same as most people did instinctively, that I didn't have that girl energy. And so I cried and cried and cried. And I think I made a decision never to ever dress in anything but what made me feel comfortable.
But I think what your children want to wear, you should allow them to explore that in a way, to find that uncomfortability.
I agree. I mean, I think that, you know, obviously the generation of my grandmother was that you presented a certain look to the world, and that's the sort of person you were judged by how you look and what you wore. And for her, that was very important, and for me, less so. I mean, my favourite compliment, I have a wonderful writer friend called Sam Strauss, who's incredibly talented. She did Dance Academy and all of that. She calls me a brilliant unmade bed. And to me, that is the ultimate in compliments, because of course, the brilliant part, forget about that, but the unmade bed.
But that sounds warm and cozy to me.
Yeah, but it's also just affectionate. You know, I do look like an unmade bed. The people in Radioland can't see it, but I never brush my hair, and and I'm always crumpled and wearing whatever I throw on in the morning.
What have you found on the floor?
Yeah, so I just, I want to be comfortable in life.
What's the relationship like, or what was your relationship like with your parents growing up?
Interesting question, because it was very good. My mother's a very intelligent person, and as such was very open-minded, despite coming from a less educated and a more conservative background, in the fact that it was working class, but a lot of people didn't really understand. There was a lot of intolerance where I lived towards migrants and definitely towards gay people. And my mother wasn't like that, and she was very sort of careful to make sure that I understood that everybody is equal and there should be no homophobia.
Mm.
Even before I came out as gay, long before when I was a child, she really
was already teaching you that.
Very much so. Now, my dad might call someone a poofter or an eye tie or a...
What's an eye tie? I haven't heard that
an
one.
An Italian. Oh. Let's say a wog or a wop or a whatever. And all these words that he used to use. Now, he wasn't one of those men who went around actively, you know, it's casual racism.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's very common for that generation,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, very. And casual homophobia as well. But I think I was very lucky in that I had a very supportive household. But I have several sets of parents, so it's kind of different. That was my stepfather I was talking about. My real father, I think, had struggled much more with that. But
he struggled more with your sexuality, would you say?
I would say so. He would have been embarrassed by it.
Really?
But I never gave him any room to be homophobic. I think that's one of the keys with coming, you know, into the world is... People can only be homophobic towards you mostly, unless it's a random stranger who just picks up on something and attacks you for that. The people in your life that you come across generally in work and in, you know, university or wherever you happen to be can only be homophobic if you give them the space to be.
What about the dynamics with you, with your siblings? What role did you play in those dynamics?
I have a brother who wasn't raised with me, so... When my parents split up when I was a baby, he was taken with my dad and I went with my mum, which is really unusual.
Are you close to him now, though?
We'd be like cousins. I mean, we are close, but we're not close, you know.
It's, yeah, I can imagine.
He was fine. I think he went through a stage. I remember when he came and lived with me when he was in his early 20s and I took him to a gay pub and he was a little bit... worried about that.
But he still went with you.
Yeah, he did. And he got over it because I, again, didn't give him any space to be anything but tolerant about it. Yeah, so I guess that was fine. I had another family too when I was... My mum, when she first broke up with my dad, sort of gave me to these wonderful Salvation Army people.
She gave you to them?
Well, to look after because she couldn't... There was no single mother's pension in those days.
So it was more that your mum couldn't afford to look after you or was there something else?
She had to work. I was with them for 4.5 years.
Yeah.
And those people, they had 5 kids of their own and they were beautiful family, beautiful people at Salvation Army. And I've never really come out to them. I don't think I've ever had to. They just accept who, you know, I've taken girlfriends there over years and I've taken my son and never explained myself. So I've had a lot of different experiences actually in,
wow,
in the one when you say, how do your parents or how did your childhood go?
Why did you not feel comfortable to tell these people who you were so close to and speak so affectionately of?
I feel that their religion possibly would have...
You were scared of what they were going to say to you?
I wasn't scared of what they were going to say to me. I was more not wanting to challenge their beliefs. I don't need to. I see them very irregularly.
Okay. So what's the point in upsetting them?
Well, I don't think it would upset them even. It's just an uncomfortable conversation for no apparent gain.
They've probably Googled you by now and they probably know exactly everything.
They actually know me very well and they accepted all my girlfriends, like the mother of that family.
Interesting, yeah.
Who I call Mummy Olive. She rings me and always asks after Julie. I've been with my partner for 20 years.
Yeah.
There's no secret. I just haven't actively said I'm gay.
Well, why do we need to really at the end of the day?
Well, then it makes an issue of it. I mean, that's what I'm saying. I'm who I am regardless of who I bring through the door.
At one stage, you described yourself as a complete dag. How do you see yourself now?
Uber cool. I'm joking. I'm still a dag.
Yeah.
But I know who I am much more these days, so I don't really...
You don't see yourself as much like, oh, I'm a dag.
I mean, I am a dag in the sense that I don't dress that well or I don't know all the cool things and where places to go. But I'm very much my own self and I think that's cool these days just to be who you are.
What were your hobbies and interests like when you were growing up, like throughout your childhood and into your teenage years?
Horses.
Love the horses.
Horse mad girl. Loved reading. Obviously, I was a writer from the start, so my mum got me a little portable typewriter when I was, I don't know how old, probably about 12, and I tapped out scripts and books and wrote like crazy, so that was really my... Oh, and Hollywood movies. I mean, being gay... I was a Judy Garland fan. Liza Minnelli, you know,
loved
I did
it.
The cliched kind of have to do the golden years of Hollywood.
I remember reading a story in Vanity Fair about Nicole Kidman and she was growing up in Sydney and she loved reading books because of escapism. Do you relate to that in some way?
Yeah, definitely. I loved reading because, like, writing allows me to create entire worlds of fantasy, I suppose. I can do anything in a book or a story.
You can go anywhere.
And go anywhere and be anyone and have, you know, friendships with anyone. And the same, I guess, when you're reading, you learn the power of that you can actually be transported. And I went to drama school with Nicole. And one of the things that I remember about her, she was only 13, I was 14 when we started. And we went to that drama school for 2 years. I don't remember her ever saying one word in those 2 years. She was very shy, like painfully shy. Now I realise, looking back, I just thought she was boring at the time. Sorry, Nicole, but I did. I'm like, why is this chick getting all the roles and I'm getting none?
Yeah.
But I now realise that she was very shy.
What age was it that you came out? Like, I don't necessarily know if it was a coming out party, but what age did you recognise your sexuality and tell people?
I was 16 when I had my first...
Girlfriend.
Well, like sexual experience, which was awesome. yeah, and prior to that, I probably knew for a little while. I do have a diary. I kept a diary from ages 13 through to 18. Mm. And every day I'd write down what happened. And I was trawling it, you know, in my 30s, and I came across this scene and I remembered vividly. I was probably about 15, just in my last year of school. And I'd gone out in the middle of class to go to the girls' toilet, and it was a girls' school. And I walked downstairs, and there were these two girls with their arms around each other, and they were coming up the stairs. I didn't know these girls. But one of them said, "You see this girl likes you." And I looked at her, and I was a little bit freaked out. And they walked past me up the stairs and then called over the top of the stairs, "She wants to kiss you." And I ran for my life to the toilet, and I wrote in my diary that night, "Dirty lesbians, they are disgusting," and all of this stuff, which I, in big writing, like, I really got very angry about it. And I had no memory of that until I looked back at the diary at the time. So I was obviously in a little bit of denial at the time, and I found that whole idea of being gay scary. And yet, all my primary school life, I'd been called a lemon and had been very clearly sort of set aside as somebody who was probably gay. And so there was this real duality of, like, my worlds where I knew, but then I didn't know, and they were the other.
If you could go back and give some advice to Sarah Walker as, like, a 12-year-old, what advice would you give her?
Do everything exactly the same. Just go for it, because it's all that time, as painful as it was, I wouldn't swap any of it, because I was an alcoholic. I am an alcoholic, but I had a really bad drinking problem for those years. I mean, I've been effectively sober for 26 or 27 years. But because I had that substance abuse problem back then, I certainly did a lot of things that made my writing more interesting.
Can you tell me the story about John Travolta?
John Travolta? Oh, in the play. Okay. So I was 14 and I'd answered an ad in the newspaper, but when people used to actually read newspapers still. And it had an ad for a young playwrights conference. You had to write a script. So, you know, writing being my hobby at the time, I wrote a script and sent it off to the Young Playwrights Conference and got accepted. It was terribly exciting. And that night they took us to the theatre. And I had been to the theatre once before to see Jesus Christ Superstar, but that was kind of one of those big shows.
Like an arena spectacle.
Yeah, I was seven or something. So I'd never actually been to the theatre where, you know, it was drama.
Yeah.
And we were ushered into the downstairs theatre. And in those days, it was just steps. So if you were sitting on one step behind you, the person behind you was sitting with their feet on the step behind your bottom. And when I went into that theatre, sitting on the step behind me was John Travolta. And it was very bizarre, really, when you think about it. You know, you're coming from Wally Park.
Yeah.
And you've seen Grease a million times. And there is the beautiful John Travolta sitting behind you in a little tiny theatre in Sydney. It was so exciting.
I think by that stage, you know, obviously you were talking about the fact that you did have a passion for writing.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you think makes a good writer?
I think having a very vivid internal voice and an eye for detail. I love taking photos as well. It's about looking at things differently. A lot of people don't notice. Photographers, like writer-directors, I think are the same, and I think that's why there are so many writer-directors. They see things, and they see the world in a way that not everybody does. It's having an outside perspective on what's going on in front of you and how you would interpret that in writing or on film or in any other way, you actually have both an internal dialogue plus a perspective on life that allows you to see things unfolding objectively so that you can describe it.
What was your first experience into media?
After I did the Young Playwrights Conference, I decided to be an actress. And so I went to drama school. And then as a result of that, I think I got a few little bit parts here and there and things. So, yeah, I guess I feel like I've been in the industry since I was 14. If you were to ask me, I would say that's my introduction into the industry. And then as a writer, I did come back through as a journalist and I went to university and I published books then. So I consider that part of the industry also.
What was it like to be on the other side of the fence? Because, I mean, you're writing now, but then looking back to being an actor, was that sort of helping you have a complex understanding of how to tell a story?
I learned a lot about writing for screen from acting because I learned what it's like when you're putting words in people's mouths. It's very good to know what it's like to have to interpret those on the other side of the camera. So when I write dialogue, I think about it from an actor's perspective sometimes.
And what study did you get? So which university did you go to?
I went to UTS and did a BA in communications.
And then at the same time, were you working in magazines and then also writing a book? Yeah, so you had like a few things going on at that stage.
Yeah.
So writing and education on how to do so, but then also you were getting a lot of experience.
Yeah, I think I never stopped writing. So I was always writing something. And as it happened, when I went to university, which I went as a mature age student, so I was 23, and I happened to be working as a journalist. So I was working there. I was at university learning to write theoretically as well, which I think was a massive bonus. And one of my teachers there was Amanda Laurie. And in one of the classes, I started a teenage novel and I gave her, I think I only had to give her one chapter to pass the class. And she gave it back to me and said, write another one. And so I wrote another one every time she asked me until I had 10 chapters and I had a book. That's how I wrote my first book, because I had a university lecturer who encouraged me to continue with my task, at the end of which I had a book and that got published.
How many books did you manage to write during your study at university? Was it two?
I think I had two then, and then I think I've ended up with about six, but I haven't written a book for a very long time.
Those two books that you wrote in university, they were young adult novels. Mm-hmm. What happened with those books? What were they about?
The first book I wrote was called The Year of Freaking Out. That was the one that my teacher kept telling me to continue writing. And it was a coming out story. So my year of freaking out was my year of coming out, I guess. It was just a story about a young girl who realizes she's gay and tells her parents. But I remember taking it to a publisher and they wanted it, but they were sort of cautiously saying, oh, well, we don't think it's a first book. And I was trying to figure out what they meant by that. And I realized that they didn't want me to be pinned as a gay writer.
But they wouldn't say that to you?
No, because that would be homophobic and a little bit wrong. So they didn't say that, but they felt if I wrote a heterosexual novel first, then it would give me more leeway going forward.
Do you think it did?
I think it, yeah, it did. I only wrote a couple more books.
Have LGBTI themes always been prevalent in your work?
Yeah, I guess they have. It hasn't always been deliberate, though. I mean...
Or was it maybe a lack of representation of gay characters on screen or in stories that you felt there was an absence of that you were trying to contribute?
I did try to contribute wherever I could because I was interested in it. Like, how many hours of television have I written? I freak out just thinking about it, like plotting it over the years. Of all those hours, I've spent 90% of those in heterosexual land. So I always did look for chances and opportunities to tell stories that I was interested in romantically, if you like, because you do have to think about your characters. You live their lives for them. If you're writing a character, you have to think about how they feel, which puts you in their shoes. So if you're constantly in the shoes of a heterosexual man or a woman, it's fine when you're playing this heterosexual man side of it. But, you know, sometimes you just want to play out a gay story. Because that's where your heart is. And I always was aware that there was a percentage of the audience who felt the same way and who weren't being represented. And that was a problem. And as I didn't see why there couldn't be gay stories on air.
You loved the TV show Number 96.
I did. Candy Raymond.
How did that impact your life when you saw the first gay characters being seen on telly?
I wasn't as... I mean, I was aware of it. I was 10 years old when that came out, and I was watching it with my parents, who are very liberal people, thankfully. Not a lot of censorship in my house, and I appreciate that. Joe Hashem and Duddles, they didn't really rate for me. I understood that there was scandal around it, and my parents explained it to me why, you know, and that everyone was talking about it. But I was more interested in Candy Raymond's character because I had a crush on her. So, you know, that it kind of went over my head, although I suppose it did sink in internally.
It did resonate in some way.
Yeah, some way.
If you're just joining us, we are currently talking to Sarah Walker, who is an Australian screenwriter. Her working credits include everything from Home and Away through to Wentworth, and she has an original series coming out on Netflix next year. What was the goal when you started working out in writing scripts, like when you first started writing stuff?
I wanted to write a feature film that would win an Oscar. I think that's still my goal. The world has changed. Television is now where it's at, so nobody's making films anymore, and I think the goals shifted for a lot of people, but mine remain the same, and that makes me old school, I suppose. I still want to write a feature film and win an Oscar.
Are you sitting on that story? Like, do you know what that story is going to be?
No, I don't know what it is. I hope it will reveal itself over time.
Isn't it interesting, and how do you feel about heterosexual actors having to play gay characters?
Well, I do not have a problem with that. I would say almost every single, up to a certain point in my life, every single gay character there ever was played by a heterosexual actress, almost entirely. I mean, I'm sure some of them were bi, and I'm sure some of them, you know.
It was Hollywood, so yeah.
But I don't have a problem with it, and I don't have a problem because actors are actors. That's what they do. They act. And I believe that if you reversed that equation and said lesbians should be cast in lesbian roles, does that mean all those lesbian actresses out there can't play straight women? Really?
Flip it and look at it like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I find it really problematic that we're having those conversations. And I know some people in the community find it problematic that we're not having those conversations and that there are things happening. But I really don't believe that any actor should be stopped from taking any role on the basis of gender or sexuality.
Well, I guess they should be a canvas, but the only issue that I have with this whole scenario is that if you look at Love, Simon, the main character is played by a boy who is, you know, a straight actor in real, straight man in real life, and his heteronormative behavior seems like it's more digestible because they're sort of shaving that element off what I think a real gay person comes across as. You're kind of missing that. But maybe that's more of a question of his talent in portraying that story and less about the absence of the essence of someone's sexuality.
And that's so hard to define. I don't look at that boy and think, oh, you're straight. I wouldn't know. I've often wondered what makes us the way we are as gay people. And this is obviously everybody's on a scale. I'm not talking about everybody, but I do think, well, I am more mannish, you know, and I only want to wear certain sorts of clothes. And nobody taught me that. Nobody made me feel that I had to be that way to be gay. It's who I am, and it has always been from the time when I didn't want to put bikini tops on. I wasn't looking at myself as a boy, but I just didn't want to wear those clothes. So, look, I think those are really interesting and unknowable things in us as gay people, but I don't think that a boy who's straight playing a gay guy or a woman who's straight playing a lesbian can't get in touch with that side of themselves. I know it's, you know, very inflammatory in some circles, but I really don't want there to be rules about art. Art needs to be art, and the artists making the art need to be able to make it the way that they want it to be made, and that means choosing the people involved. It's a very tricky landscape.
What was your first paid script writing job?
Well, I'd been working as a chief sub, and I got a phone call from Des Monahan, who was just setting up Screen Time. And he telephoned me at work and said, hello, this is going to sound very odd, but I'm a television producer and I was wondering if you'd like to come and work in TV, because he'd read a short story of mine and had seen that I had a bio that said I'd been an actor, and they were looking for fresh voices.
So you're saying it's basically an accident that you stumbled across?
Well, I definitely got the offer on a random phone call from a TV producer who wanted fresh voices in television. So yeah, he gave me a job on a TV show that they were developing. And when that didn't come up, I was working within that group and they did Breakers. And so they moved me on to Breakers, and that was my first paid gig in TV.
There was a bit of controversy with your writing for that show, Breakers, with some of the characters being a bit edgy. There was a senator that was very upset about the writing of the show Breakers. He was just thought the characters were a little bit too edgy for Australian television.
Well, this has been a problem in Australian television for a long time. We all have to write the same show over and over and over and over again in different variations, and it's continuing to this day. There are some wonderful shows out there that have broken those kind of molds, but a lot of commercial networks in particular still believe that Australians still want to watch a certain type of television and a certain formula and a certain type of
and
character.
And we don't.
Well, that's why TV, you know, free-to-air is dying, although there are some hit shows still that are still in that vein.
I mean, I think Wentworth's just as well written as your Game of Thrones or any of the other ones that are being celebrated internationally.
It was funny because I've actually got a project at the moment that is being produced by Charlize Theron in the States, and it's a Netflix show.
Is she going to be in it?
No, she's producing it. We were pitching the show and we were talking about certain shows that she loved. She brought up Wentworth.
Get out.
Was raving about Wentworth and was raving about, you know, Danielle Cormack, who plays
yes.
B.
Yeah.
And for me, when I was listening to that, I was thinking, yeah, I know it is great hearing people in international places who we rate at that level really enjoying our material as well.
Is there a challenge to writing LGBTI characters? I mean, there was initially some negative responses from your writing of LGBTI characters. Was it shocking to you that it was such a big uproar about it?
Disappointing more than shocking, I think. What I was worried about was the fact that there was no support at the network when there was a problem. Apparently, it wasn't going to be conversations about gayness that they wanted to have around the water cooler. And they do listen to a particular sector of the community who are the ones who write and complain, but aren't really representative of the entire community. And I think we saw that with the same-sex marriage debate. Is that there was a lot of vocal
negativity
and no-sayers that eventually proved not to be the majority.
You were told that no one wanted to see gay people on the small screen in prime time at one stage.
Mm.
What year was that?
Well, it probably would have been about 6 years ago, 7 years ago.
So 6 years ago, someone said to you that no one wants to see LGBTI characters.
Roughly around that time, yeah. I mean, if you're gay in the industry or whatever, you're considered to be pushing a barrow all the time if you suggest gay characters. Straight people can come into a television room where you're writing and making up things and start saying, let's have a gay character or let's make them gay. And that's perfectly fine. But if I was to say it, everyone would be saying, oh, you're being, you know, you're pushing a barrow. Of course you'd want a gay character, which makes me unable as much as some other people now to actually suggest it because it makes it look like I'm only servicing my own interests.
Yeah.
Fortunately now everybody has to have a gay character practically in television, so it's changing.
Well, you know, 6 years ago I was on a television show here in Australia called Big Brother, which you didn't watch because it was reality television. No one was writing for me except my weird brain. Yeah. But I was told that no one had ever won a reality TV show that was gay.
Yeah.
And I won. And it was because I just, instead of going on that show and being like, I'm gay, I'm gay, I'm gay, I just was like myself. And there were so many people. And the one story that resonates with me was I did a radio show the day after and the host of the show said, we're going to take a call. The first call, there was two. The first one, the lady said, I was so scared of what to say to my children with you being on my TV every night, being a gay person. And she said, I didn't know what to say to my children. And then when I told my daughter and my son that you were gay, they said, can we have carrots for dinner? It just was, it's a non-event for the children because, you know, and she was the one holding all this fear, but then it was nothing for them.
Yeah.
And then this other lady rang me and she said, which still makes me a little bit emotional. I was sitting with my mum while doing these interviews and she said about an hour after the show, her son walked in and said to her, I think I'm gay. And I want you to love me the way that Ben's mum loves him.
Oh, my God.
And I think it was like Kyle and Jackie O, where you're not supposed to be like, you know, a blubbering mess. We were like, wow, well, you don't really set out to be a certain way on telly. I certainly didn't.
Mm.
But it resonated with people in a way. And it was only 6 years ago that I guess I was a gay person on television helping change that understanding.
Mm.
And I think we have come a long way.
A super long way. I mean, everything, we're not even going to be having these conversations soon, which will be great. I just wanted to say about that, I'd actually written the character, I was actually asked to write the prettiest character in our series at the time, which was Home and Away, played by Esther Anderson, to make her gay, have a little gay fling by the producer. It wasn't my idea because I wouldn't have suggested such a thing. You know, I could bring in a guest character or whatever, but they suggested it. And so I did do that character for 8 weeks. I had a plan of how it would be, and I allowed there to be room for her lover to come back if it worked.
Did it work?
It did work, but that's the one that they came back and said, we don't want to see that on our screen anymore.
So that's 6 years ago that happened on Home and Away?
That's what I'm saying. I can't remember exactly what. It could have been more. It could have been 10 now. You lose track of time, but it was somewhere between 10 and 6 years ago.
Where are we, people, when we think about this story? Think, you know, in years to come, when we look back and think about when marriage equality happened or when we had gay characters on television, it's going to shock everyone when we go, it was 10 years ago. You know what I mean?
Yes.
When we look back and we go, oh, it was only 6 years ago.
And that they listened to that, and that was okay to say that. I think I've said this before, but had that person been Indigenous or, you know, had someone come in and said, we don't want to see that shit on television, that would have been highly offensive and, you know, that person would have been in trouble for talking about it that way. But it was okay to talk about gay people in that way, and it was considered natural.
Well, an executive producer said to me, you know why you went on to do nothing after being on Big Brother? You know, you're a great personality. You could have worked in media. He said, it's because you're gay. He said, you know, the network was not going to pick you up because of your sexuality. It was shocking to me. But that was being said to me.
As if it was okay.
It was as blatant as being said that, you know, you're a faggot or something, you know, or saying that something derogatory about a minority. But it was said in a room with people who didn't flinch. And I remember sort of looking around this room and being like, are we in like a work environment where someone basically told me that I have no career because my sexuality or something that I do in my private life is holding me back?
It would have been considered that you shouldn't have had a problem with that, that was just a known thing, something that you should know.
Just go, oh yeah, well, yeah. I'll take that on board and I'm not going to be hurt about it. Where in actual fact, you walk out and you think, I'm going to need therapy at some point in my life because that's not okay for someone to say that to you.
Well, the sad thing for me was that why I wanted to go back to that conversation was because Esther got so many, she got inundated with letters from people. Now, for every letter, you know, you don't actually get a lot of letters on shows like that. That people don't sit down and write stuff. But there are a lot of people who are poisonous about things. But the volume of letters she got from young people who were watching that series, who were gay and who were seeing themselves, you know, and felt better about themselves because of it, was incredibly touching and so important. But those voices and those letters, the network didn't care about them.
You did write a character for All Saints and you wrote this character to be gay. And then I don't know whether or not you stopped writing for the program before they changed this character back to being straight. But was it really weird to have this experience of writing a character on All Saints, have them come out and then have that reversed?
Again, disappointing more than weird. I actually expected it. It was hard. I mean, it wasn't that hard to get that character across the line. I chose her to be gay, Dr. Beaumont, played by Tammy McIntosh. And it was exciting to have a character that came in, you know, she had dogs and a female lover. But we couldn't see that. We couldn't see her because we couldn't afford the guest that would be her girlfriend. And it's one of the technical problems that I've spoken about before about having gay people in television on these sorts of long-running shows, because you have a limited number of cast. And the cast, generally speaking, have to be able to be matched up along romantic lines.
So let's just say we put 6 people in a show, 3 boys, 3 girls. I guess if you turn 2 of the boys gay, you've only got 1 boy left for the girls to fight over.
Yeah, and then 2 girls have no one to play with. So it really does make a difference on a technical production level. Here's another thing. You don't want to write, you know, your first gay married couple on television and then have them break up all the time. So you want that to be a positive, happy representation. Otherwise, you're going to get caned, right? Of course, the gay couple break up and get back together, or they're bad for each other, Now, where there's no conflict, there's no drama. So writing a happy couple is as boring as batshit on television. So now your only other choice is to break them up. And then if you've got them broken up, who can they get with? There's no one else in the cast who is gay. So then you've got a choice about writing a story where someone else who's straight turns, which is maybe okay, But then there's the whole coming out story and the drama about being gay and the fact that the gay person's been predatory and broken up a straight couple. It's a minefield, really.
Do you feel like there's a bit of hypocrisy in the fact that there are so many gay people working in the TV industry, but they aren't being represented on screen?
It's a really funny thing because actually quite a much higher level, a percentage of people in the industry are gay compared to how many there are in the world. Like that percentage is out of proportion in the field of arts and entertainment, I guess.
Well, queer equals creative. You know, there's a lot more creative minds, I would say.
Yes, that's potentially right, that, you know, maybe gay people as part of their makeup are more creative. I don't know about that. I also don't know whether it's because they're more traumatised or they feel more outside society or they're more, they feel they've been oppressed, and that makes a creative energy in itself. I don't think if we represented the industry on screen, you would have 50% of people in every show gay, and that's not representative either. I know that I feel like the industry has let the gay community down over years of not insisting, not standing up and saying we have to have more visibility on the screens and we have to have and to stop the homophobia inside. And it's maybe some of it's internalized type of homophobia, but certainly a great number of people I work with are gay, and yet we still couldn't get the gay stories on screen.
Well, David Sale, the creator of Number 96, believes that the current landscape is much less brave than what he thought it was back in the day. Do you think the current shows are playing it safe sometimes?
Yes, although that's changing really rapidly at the moment. I would say it almost every other era of my industry, if you'd asked me that question, there was a resounding yes. Now, it's not the same. Already, the whole industry, the landscape has changed. Characters are gay, characters are queer.
Can we talk about the real things behind these characters instead of them just being 2D? Like, as in, are we going to get to a point where characters that maybe on Offspring or on Home and Away are taking PrEP, you know, which is the prevention drug that's been created to stop people from getting HIV, or have really feminine characters or really butch characters, you know, like instead of having them 2D, make them 3D. When are we going to start talking about real people and having us being portrayed like real people?
Don't know the answer to that question. When I think if we're a minority,
yeah,
and we are still, I think, then there's only a minority of people who are going to be interested in that. In those issues.
That's so true.
And so the networks are still going to say, well, you know, that's interesting to you guys, but I'm not really interested in that. So, and I don't think the bulk of our public are. But I guess as more people coming through, I do think that there's a push in television towards learning the truth behind things and coming from a place of reality and authenticity in their creations. So people, they want creators who are what they're creating. For instance, I was talking about my friend Fadia Aboud, who I've had the privilege of working with. She is an Arab woman writing about Arab women. 5 years ago, it would have been me writing stories about Arab women. If a network had wanted such a thing, it would have been us making up stories about a community we know nothing about.
Which is so wrong.
Yeah.
It's so wrong.
Well, I mean, the shows didn't exist as well because...
Another thing.
Yeah. But I think now what we're getting is this real desire for people to see things they haven't seen before and to lift the lid on areas of the community that hasn't been lifted before. And we will start to get much more truthful and authentic representations on screen. And because there's so much more opportunity to broadcast, so you have a lot more broadcasters and different ways of watching, you can find the ones that you want. So the networks will start putting on stuff that's only going to appeal to 10% of the population in every type of drama. You know, so you will find your niche and the audience will find the material that's out there. Or it may be all mainstream. Like if it's a good show, and I'm not saying that they put it out and say only 10% of people can watch it. What I'm saying is they put it out there and it finds its audience. If that's only 10% of people, fine.
But that's what's missing, I think, in lots of people's pitches for shows. I think what we want to see now, or what people are interacting with, is curiosity. Mm. So people are watching shows if they're curious to find out or they're learning something. And that's what I think has been missing. But that's, I think, where this new landscape is with HBO and these... Netflix, we're having more of an opportunity to explore those stories about things that we don't know about.
It's still a struggle to get the voices onto air, but ultimately I believe as there's more and more TV being made, those voices will come there's a lot of talent coming up where it's much more metrosexual as well.
Right.
I don't know whether that's even a thing anymore. But, you know, when I say that, I mean people are coming up and gender and sexuality aren't really coming into it. And, in fact, I want to tell you quickly a story. Okay, so I was interviewing directors for this Netflix series that I've got going, and it's, you know, wonderful directors. And one of them was an older guy. He loved it. He thought it was fantastic. And the two central characters are young women. So they're like in between 19 and 23 mostly for most of it. And these two women are being played by very substantial actresses in the world. And he was talking about the material with me. And as he talked about it, despite his passion for it, what I was hearing was voyeurism. What I was hearing was an older man standing outside the characters and watching them be young women. And then I noticed the young male directors that I was talking to, gender never came into it. The fact that whether they were women or men was immaterial. They were interesting characters.
Mm.
And the story we were telling was interesting. And their experience of the world was what they were passionate about. And the difference in talking to those young men to talking to the older guy was not about my age either. It wasn't about how they were relating with me. Mm. It was about a certain sense where, honestly, the gender of the protagonist was immaterial, and it made me so happy that I had sensed this incredible equality between genders that's coming through from the next generation, and I'm really excited about it.
Who, as actors at the moment, do you enjoy writing for?
Well, Danielle Cormack is actually one of them. I'm working on a couple of projects with her, and we're actually, one of them is her project. I'm excited about the fact that I'm working in a time when older women who are female protagonists in television are coming to the fore. So you're Robin Wrights and so on overseas. I really do love to work with and for a strong female protagonist and the actresses who play those. So I'd love to work with, well, actually there's so many of them. They're all fabulous, but they're really highly intelligent. When you find all these women have something in common, they're really strong and they're really highly intelligent.
What did you think of Big Little Lies then?
I hate it now because they stole my director, my US thing, my wonderful Andrea Arnold, who's doing season two of Big Little Lies, and I don't hate them at all. And I wish them an incredible second success, because all I know is that it has Meryl Streep in it. And when I found out, I texted Andrea with just like 60,000 exclamation marks and Meryl Streep. And it was just like, because, you know, that is insane. Now Meryl Streep's doing television. Gates are open. Everybody can do television.
Well, she knows. Like, I don't know where it was. I think it was an interview that was an Audible interview that I listened to where she was saying something similar to what you said earlier. You know, no one's making films anymore. Yeah. And this landscape of TV is so exciting because we've been told for so long that we've got an hour and 20 minutes to tell a story on the big screen. You're telling me we can tell a story about a strong woman for 9 episodes, you know, that we're going to tell this over 9 hours?
Yeah,
for an exactly. actor, they're like, oh, you know, let's get involved in that.
And a lot more television is being made like one long feature film. That's why you're having one director. I'm sure that Andrea will do an amazing job of this, and I can't wait. Yes, look, a whole bunch of very strong female actresses together. That's my idea of heaven. I find, you know, women are so complex. I mean, so are men, but I don't understand them as well. And I'm putting my hand up to say I've actually written a couple of things with male protagonists that I've voluntarily written as dual male protagonists. I still love that territory. But there's something about working with an actress, actually writing for them, that I really enjoy.
The only shows I like, which people are probably going to think I'm crazy, but I mainly only watch Australian-made shows and I only like Australian films. Even if we got one a year, I would go and see it like 4 times. And I can't tell you, Sarah, why I feel that way.
It's hearing our voices. I actually mean literally Australian voices. Mm. You know, there is something really precious about that, that you know, we don't want to lose in this whole, you know, reach for American everything. I really feel like it's so important still to see us as characters. I went and saw Breath this week. Fantastic job, like really well done, Simon Baker, on so many levels. But there was a young character in it called Looney. He was your quintessential Australian kid, you know, that young, like larrikin kid. The audience just recognized and laughed so often through that. not that what he was saying was particularly funny, but they know that boy.
Mm.
And I think as an audience, you need to hear your own voice.
What about dark themes, though? Like, I think for a long time I felt like this, and I think a lot of people were like, well, we only know how to tell cops and robbers, or we only know how to tell really bleak stories about our Australia. Do you think there's been a shift from where that was to where we are now?
The shift is still happening, I think.
Yeah.
I was pitching about 5 years ago, pitching to do zombies in Sydney, and laughed out of the room. And this is before Walking Dead was huge.
What it is. With 13 Reasons Why, Glee, Riverdale, there's lots of American TV shows including gay characters. I mean, can you compare what they're doing in America to what was happening here in Australia? Are they being more inclusive of gay characters? Are they adopting it faster than we are?
They've probably adopted it slightly faster. Yes, I would say that's a fair call. And they did the L word like ages and ages ago. I think that they've definitely done it sooner, but we are now catching up. And I can't imagine, like so many of the developments that I've been on recently have gay characters, and it's just a matter of course at the moment. So how they're going to be portrayed and whether or not we're going to go into the truth of their stories, I don't know. But the fact is that they're coming through. So I think that we'll see a new generation of Australian content that has gay character.
I remember it wasn't that long ago that I was told that we wouldn't see like a Clueless or a Legally Blonde with the protagonist being a gay character. What did you think of Love, Simon?
Love, Simon, I enjoyed very much, and there was a moment in the end of the film and the audience was very mixed and, as far as I could tell, quite straight actually.
Mm.
And they cheered like with their hands and mouths in the cinema, which is not that common anymore. That was pretty moving to be in that audience and realise that a romance film like that is going to move people to cheer.
There's obviously different levels of satisfaction in what you've achieved. Is there something in particular that you feel really proud of?
I'm about to be really proud of something I've done. So I'm actually proud of everything I've done, because it feels like everything I do leads me to where I am. So it doesn't matter whether it's Home and Away or Neighbours or Wentworth or Wonderland. I feel like everything has taught me my craft, and I am proud of everything. I'm about to take hopefully a new step into a next level in the States, and I still want to work here and I still want to be proud of work I'm doing here, but I'm hoping that this will open doors for me. And I'm hoping if the material is as good as I believe it and want it to be, then it will be something I'm very proud of.
How do you feel about equal visibility for all letters of the LGBTI alphabet?
I feel strongly that every single person in the world should be visible regardless of their gender or how they choose to represent themselves in our landscape or any other. I believe everybody should be equal.
Absolutely. But do you think that there's more visibility? Say, there was last year a lot of people talking through the marriage equality campaign that if you Googled it, people talked more about gay men. They didn't talk enough about gay women, or they didn't talk enough about trans people. Do you feel like that there is a lack of visibility for other letters of our alphabet beyond the gay man?
Definitely. There is less visibility for some letters in that acronym. I think that's about the number of people who are representative of that letter, and it's about the fact that people can latch on to because they've been listening to it for thousands of years and have only just made them visible. Gay men and gay women, lesbians, we're allowed to be visible now, but you think about how long that's taken people to wrap their heads around that, and we've been a very kind of identifiable community inside other communities for centuries. Now we've got new letters to identify and understand and relate to, but a lot of people don't understand, they can't grasp what they are or who they are, and they need them to look a certain way and be a certain fixed thing. Everybody wants to label everything, and it's just a natural, I don't know if you know this, but sort of zoologically, when you first meet someone, the first thing that you're brain registers, which is a primitive part of your brain, is whether they're a man or a woman. You're not even registering it and thinking about it. However, if you can't identify whether it's a man or a woman, then you start to think about it. And we've only just got back past male, female, and now sexuality.
Mm.
day. We've added one. To do the next part is going to take a long time, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't be spending a lot of time trying to do it. But I'm just saying it's a big uphill battle, and it's not about people not wanting to embrace it and encompass it. They just don't understand what it is.
I think we're going to get there by sharing stories, and as a writer and an auteur, I guess, in a way, continue to share stories of all of us. You know, write stories that are rich, that are flawed, you know, and that's how we're going to get to where we're going to get to.
I agree. Storytelling is not over by a long shot. We have to keep doing it forever.
Well, you're doing it very well.
Thank you.
And I've just been having the best time of my life, and I'm sure there's a lot of people listening to this right now that feels the same way. Privileged to have you on the show Word for Word. Have you got a message for the queer community that is listening to the show right now?
Yeah, start writing your stories. I mean, bring stories to... If you have stories to tell, then let's hear them, because I think our voices have to be authentically brought to the screen or to books or whatever it is. And until people start telling their stories, we're not going to be able to do that kind of education of the wider community that we'd hope.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on
Thanks
Word
for having
Word.
Me. I've had such a good time. I feel like I've talked your ears off, but thank you.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Ben Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network. Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.